Hello and welcome to the Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Fospero. NASA has announced a target of September 2025 for Artemis II, the first crewed Artemis mission around the moon. And in 2026, it's hoped they'll land the first astronauts near the lunar South Pole. Dr. Tess Morris-Patterson is an aerospace physiologist, and her day job involves selecting astronauts for such missions. She collaborates with national space agencies, including NASA, is an expert in microgravity, and founded her own business, Astro Perform, to select and prepare candidates for the challenges of spaceflight. Tess is also a British Army Reserve officer. She's worked at Sandhurst and, as an avid light aircraft pilot, has attempted world records. She spent a decade in elite sport, working with Premier League football clubs, Formula One teams, and some of the finest athletes in the world, before moving into human spaceflight. And fresh from leading a skiing expedition, she's here today. Tess, gosh, what an introduction, ending with before moving into human spaceflight. I'm so excited to hear your story today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here, Helen. I'm quite tired, actually, just listening to my own introductions. No, but thank you for the kind introduction. That's great.
It's quite impressive. You seem to have fitted in a number of careers into a fairly short time, because looking at you, you're way younger than I am, and I'm not sure how you've done it all. But tell me first of all about being an aerospace physiologist and exactly what that is.
Yeah, it's quite a mouthy title. So essentially it's someone who has trained in physiology, and it's someone who has then transitioned that expertise into spaceflight, human spaceflight. So it's looking at how the body adapts to microgravity.
And what is microgravity?
So microgravity is what normal people would describe as zero G, but there's actually not zero gravity in space by the pure fact that you're constantly falling. So actually there is a little bit of gravity, but not much.
So that's where the micro comes in.
Yes, exactly.
And what was it that made you interested in space in the first place and transitioning into the world of astronauts and space travel?
So I worked with athletes for a long time, about 10 or 12 years. And I kind of felt like I'd got to a position where I'd achieved everything that I wanted to. And that sounds really absurd, actually, looking back. But I'd reached a point where actually I needed something that would really excite me and really challenge me. And I had an intern at the time who was describing one of my methods that I had developed for athletes, a research project. And she was saying, oh, do you know that would work with astronauts very well? I said, how do you know that? And she said, oh, I've been studying at King's College London. I've been looking at space flight and things like that. And I was like, wow, okay. When you just get a spark of joy and you're, wow, I really need to look into this because this feels like a path I should follow. And I did.
And was it an easy path to get into or to navigate your way through?
It seemed to open doors for me, and I'm not quite sure how that has happened in life generally, but I've been very lucky that actually I've had a lot of amazing contacts and a lot of amazing mentors. And I think it's been about meeting the right people at the right time. So I met an amazing woman called Susie Zanello, and I had her on a podcast, and she explained to me the route that I might take in order to start working in this area. And I just put my idea out there, and then people seemed to grasp it. So I was very fortunate.
And you went to International Space University, which just takes me back to my careers teacher. And I was offered Nottingham, not International Space University. I've never even heard of that. That sounds so exciting.
It is. And actually, it's exactly what you would imagine. We had a Star Trek night, for instance, to celebrate one evening. And no, it's full of the type of people that you'd imagine that are all incredible in their own right. I had people from China, Russia, Canada, all across the world on my course. And one of our projects included working with Buzz Aldrin. So it's exactly the kind of place that you'd imagine in your mind.
Oh, that's amazing. What was that like?
Incredible. Well, he's very passionate for a start, describing, for instance, the type of lunar orbit that we might need. And we were sort of hypothetically developing a method to get to Mars quicker in order to make it more efficient so that humans can get there faster. And his ideas were just, well, it's Buzz Aldrin, so they were out of this world, weren't they? But he's very kooky as a person. He wears two watches and has big flag socks. He's exactly as you would imagine watching him on telly.
Did you get a chance to talk to him and ask him a bit about his experiences?
Yes, a little. He's kind of followed a little bit with an entourage, and mostly he wants to talk about the things that he's passionate about, which is human spaceflight, going back to the moon, going to Mars. So we kind of mostly had geeky chats, if I'm honest, rather than his past experience. But yeah, it was brilliant.
And where is International Space University?
It's based in Strasbourg in France, but they have it every year in a different location. So one year it might be in China, one year it might be in Australia. And then this year it's in Houston, Texas. So at the very heart of human spaceflight. So a really exciting year for them.
And then when you go there, and I know you also worked with NASA's research center as well to get experience, in those early days of learning about space, did you see straight away where you would fit in and where your skill set would fit in? Or was it a more general introduction and then fathoming out where you would be useful?
Yeah, so I went to the Human Research Conference and I presented some of my work, and it was grasped with both hands by people there, like really impressive, important people. And I was really shocked, actually, because some of the ideas that I had and that I'd developed working in sport for 10, 12 years, they hadn't necessarily got to that point in human spaceflight. A lot of it was around the engineering, around the human, and it's very difficult. The complexity of actually having someone just to survive in space is difficult. So actually that high-end, high-performance element of astronauts performing in space, some of that I had experienced in elite sport that they hadn't necessarily got to. So yeah, I was welcomed, which is incredible.
Do you have any examples that you can share that we sort of understand where those sort of high performance lessons that you learned and ideas that you put forward in elite sport then transitioned and were embraced?
I remember a conversation that I had very clearly at a conference that I went to, a human spaceflight conference, and I was discussing with them how they select teams or how they select crew, because clearly if you're going to be in a very small module for a very prolonged period of time, the type of people that you have and how they interact is really important. But the way that they had done that to date was to select the right people and hope that they adapt. And actually that isn't necessarily how we do things moving forward. So actually my experience in working within elite sport, and actually the type of people that you select to surround the athletes and how they get on and how they make the athletes feel, that was part of my experience that I hadn't imagined I would bring to them. And the same working at NASA Gene Lab, actually, it wasn't necessarily what I knew that I brought to the table, but it was my experience with people and how I bring people together that they really appreciated at the end of the day.
So the $6 million question is, what makes a good astronaut, Tess?
Oh, goodness me. Well, there's so many components that actually it's really difficult to sum that up in one sentence. But of course, they need to be knowledgeable. They need to have the right skill set. That goes without saying. They don't need to be the best in that per se, but they need to be someone that can apply those skills in a meaningful fashion. So if you have a problem, like the toilet breaks, you need to be able to foster some of that knowledge from the past and be able to apply that so that actually you can make a difference. And that's particularly important when we go to the moon and to Mars, because you want people that will be self-starters, that can problem solve. So those little skills, actually a lot of people have, like plumbers and electricians, actually that's really important. And then the second thing is about your character. So this is something that, you know, I'm really interested in, because with all that skill set, and I've spent a history, by the way, in my past is making people physiologically better, whereas actually more so I realise that it's your psychology that is hugely important with successful missions.
So it's about character. And what are you looking for then when you're selecting candidates? What do you really hope that you'll see that will make a big difference?
So people give away aspects of their character on a regular basis. So if you know what you're looking for, and actually quite a lot of the time we glaze over little nuances of people's conversations or the way that they interact, whereas focusing on those details are, in my opinion, some of the most important, because they escalate in a situation where you might be going to Mars and you can't get away from those people for 3 years or you're on a lunar base and you can't just call, well, you can call home, but equally you're not surrounded by the same people that give you comfort and give you sustenance. Yeah, I think it's focusing in on those little things that actually you might think in your mind, oh, that's a little bit of a red flag, but I'm going to glaze over it. It's probably those things you need to really look at.
Really? So they're probably the little giveaways where maybe in your gut flags up something. And so therefore you don't gloss over that. You go a bit deeper into it.
Yeah. I'll just give you a little example, perhaps. If someone's willing to talk over you in a conversation and when you're speaking to them, they're slightly glazed over and not really listening to you fully, the skill of active listening is hugely important, because actually, if you're not really listening to someone, then you can't really action anything in relation to who that person is, if you're not willing to understand who that person is in the first place.
And presumably everything magnifies really in space, because you're in this austere, small environment where there really is no escape, is there? There's no sort of putting your hand up saying, I'm going home now, I've had enough.
Absolutely. And it's also very stressful. If one thing goes wrong, then it could be life threatening. So if you think about the kind of people that you would surround yourself right now, if you were in a life-threatening situation, I don't think you'd be able to count that many. So actually, it's those people plus the skill sets that you need. So actually, astronauts are very unique. They're also the loveliest people you'll ever meet.
So, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. The nicest people in the room. And actually, that's very difficult to not be arrogant when you're that successful.
Wow. What about coping under intense pressure? How key is it that people can cope under pressure? And how does one test that?
I think the Canadians have got a really good method of testing that, actually. We've got something called the dunk tank, which is, as you can imagine, as nice
a bit grim.
As it sounds. Yeah. But we have several in the UK, and actually you can go and do this if you'd fancy it, Helen.
Oh, thank you. Are you thinking of another podcast where you dunk me?
Absolutely. Why not? But what the Canadians do is they put them in situations like that. So that's a helicopter that gets turned upside down and gradually progresses toward being turned upside down in the dark, and you have to rescue yourself. So what they do is they do that test and then they go on to do a written exam straight after. They've not got changed. They're still dripping wet. Their head is still full of the stressful situation they've just come out of. And then they're expected to perform academically. So it's kind of switching on different parts of your brain very fast and being able to compartmentalize the stressful situation that you've had. And now I need to perform in a different manner. So it's really interesting.
Oh gosh, that sounds like a really good podcast. Damn. I'm sure I'm going to be rubbish at that. But I think it does sound like one that
we'll
should probably.
Together.
Can we go together and can you sort me out? You obviously know, and we'll talk more about Astro Perform in a minute, you exactly know what you're looking for when you're choosing. Have you ever been tempted, Tess? Because you've got such an impressive background. You're a pilot, all the experience in elite sport. You know exactly what the skills set is required. Could we see you up orbiting the moon, or have you ever thought about whether you'd actually put yourself forward as a candidate?
That was the primary reason why I left elite and professional sport, because I had a reevaluation of my life and I felt that actually there were aspects of my skill set that I didn't feel were fully optimized actually in what I was doing. And this was pointed out very vividly by my wife. We had a conversation about my career and she said, I think you might be happier elsewhere doing something else. And that was a real shocker to me, because I'd spent so much time and energy invested, and it's that whole, if you spend more time and energy in something, you're more likely to continue in that, because it's extremely hard to give that up. But there was a part of me that was like, actually, I think you're right, but what is that thing? And I was never interested in spaceflight, to be honest. In the UK, we don't have that many role models. A couple from the past, for instance, are now Tim Peake. But there was no one where I was thinking, well, actually, I would like to be that person. But then I looked at my sort of knowledge base and the skills that I have, and I thought, well, actually, I might be okay at that and I might really love it. So I put myself together a training program for a 4-year period where I executed as many of the skill sets needed to be an astronaut as possible. And as you can imagine, that was a fairly busy 4 years.
Gosh, I can imagine it was. And what happened at the end of that 4 years? Do you now put yourself forward, do you think,
well,
at some stage?
Or? Yeah, no, I did go for European astronaut selection. That happens once every 10 to 12 years. So, you know, to be honest, in Europe, you've got one shot at becoming an astronaut. And actually, I got the sort of to round two, top 6%, which sounds great. But when you think about it in relation to the other rounds that are yet to come and things like that, actually, I didn't do hugely well. But my skill set is definitely preparing other people to succeed where I failed. You know, that's not such a bad thing.
And are you up against thousands of people when they have these testing sessions?
Yeah, so the last application process for ESA, European Space Agency, was 24,500 people. And those are not just sort of ordinary people either. They're people that actually meet the criteria outset for what ESA would require for being an astronaut. They're hugely capable people. And I remember sitting there having breakfast with the six candidates that I was against. And one of them was telling me about how she had developed a new method to study black holes at Stanford University. And another chap was a test pilot, but he was a test pilot in France, speaking fluent French. And it's at this moment where you're like, wow, I'm surrounded by some incredible people. I don't know what I'm doing here, but they equally found some of the things that I did really interesting. So it's quite an interesting moment that.
And this is 24,000 or so sort of fairly suitable candidates, or certainly people who are eligible. How many are they whittling that down to?
So the first round is 1,000 people. So that already, I know so many people, honestly, who work at space agencies that are incredibly qualified, but didn't get through to that first round of testing. So that's the kind of difficulty you're against. When I left my previous job, my mentor, I remember clearly saying to me, you've got a bigger chance of becoming prime minister. Are you sure this is something you want to aim for? I think, well, actually, why not? Just purely by the fact that I sound slightly insane shouldn't really stop me, should it? But
you don't sound insane at all. And I think going through that process, I'm sure that's added to your skill set and perhaps helped you realize that where you sit really is in the selection process. But I think because you've walked on in those footsteps and tried for the selection yourself, you know exactly how to prepare people, I would have thought. And out of that, is that where the whole idea for Astro Perform came in and the realization that is perhaps where you fit in?
Definitely. So I've got a real passion for supporting and helping people to fulfill their full potential. And honestly, never in my life have I thought that I should be stopped or I'm not able to do anything. And actually, I thought everyone felt that way. And it's really sad to kind of hear from different people that actually they feel like they can't do stuff. And it frustrates me because I think, well, actually, if you prepare fully and properly and actually you put in the due diligence, there's a lot of things that are completely in your capability. And actually, I kind of wanted to evidence that myself. If I go for something and actually really put all my time and effort and energy, granted, I wasn't successful, but equally, I've gone a long way and actually learned a huge amount as well. So I like to try and foster that with people that I work with, that you can actually do anything if you fully put your 100% into it.
Tell me about the fact that we're going back to the moon, because that just fills me with excitement and fascination. I gather there's going to be a lunar orbit. Well, next year, isn't it? 2025. So what's involved and what exactly is a lunar orbit?
It keeps delaying, sadly, owing to different difficulties that we're having. But it's not an easy thing to go back to the moon. So we need to remember that. Back when we did it before, that was an absolutely astonishing achievement, as I'm sure you're aware, with the technology that we had at the time. So what we're planning on doing now is, I think it was described best actually as being a one-bedroom apartment that's flying around the moon, rather than the six-bedroom apartment that we have currently going around the Earth. And the purpose of that is that actually we can then take humans back and forth the surface of the moon, and we can start to really explore more than we have done before. We can start to understand more about the Earth's origin. And actually, we can start to really gather more information about what this amazing thing is that we always see in the sky, but actually don't know a huge amount about.
So what does the lunar orbit mean at first? Will it just be orbiting and not putting people on the moon? And then is the plan then to land people on the moon?
Yeah, exactly. It takes a really unusual orbit, actually, the Lunar Gateway, just by virtue of the fact that staying in orbit around the moon is really difficult. So you need to maintain a really interesting orbit in order to do that. That's far too geeky for our conversation today, but it's one that Buzz Aldrin is extremely passionate about, of course. So initially, we're going to have that Lunar Gateway. That obviously takes some time to be able to move that huge amount of equipment required into that orbit. And then, as you rightly said, the next stage is adding humans to that equation. And then the stage after that is to have a lunar habitat. So that'll be under the moon's surface in order to protect us from things like solar radiation. And we will have people in habitation on the moon in the not too distant future.
That's extraordinary. And when you say inhabitation on the moon, this does sound like a very naive question. But obviously, we've all got the moon landing images and the spacesuit and all that kind of thing. If they're under the ground and in a base, will the suit come off? And are they living in a way like we might be living in a basement apartment?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't sound very nice, actually, when you say it like that. And I imagine actually that's one of the challenges psychologically is to live underground, because you will have things like an airlock. So in the sense that you can go to the ISS, International Space Station at the moment, and lock yourself in and make the oxygen levels as you want them, make the temperature as you want them, etc. You'd be able to do that on the lunar. But when you go out to the moon's surface, of course, you'd need to don up a spacesuit.
What is life like? Can you give us an idea of how long it takes to get to the moon for the lunar orbit? What kind of, she says, struggling with words, capsule that you're in? What is the environment like for the people who are lucky enough and do get selected to go and do this?
It actually won't be too dissimilar to the logistics that we currently have. So it will be serviced by Dragon in terms of SpaceX. And when you put it into things like requiring laundry to be done or requiring some samples to come back, because that would be very interesting, a lot of that is actually still serviced in a similar way. You're just going further. I think, to your point, it's different to what we've done already, because actually the Earth is that much further away. So when you go to a spacewalk at the moment, you're out servicing a spacecraft that is, you're having the sun rise every 90 minutes and it's getting hot and it's getting cold. And actually that already is an environment that we're not used to at all. But the Earth is very much like seen to be rotating beneath you, and it's quite daunting, overwhelming. You can't look at it for too long because you get disorientated. But actually, you're going to be that much further. So you're going to have an amazing view of the Earth that actually very few people have had the opportunity to see. This is changing who we are as a human race, and having a lunar habitat is changing the trajectory of who we are and what we're going to become, which is one, really exciting, but also secondly, like, needs some boundaries in place to make sure that we do it really responsibly.
What about actual living conditions? What's it like for the astronauts? How much room have they got? What are sleeping conditions like? And what are those things that you're really looking out for to make sure that they can cope with what, as I described it as before, sounds like quite an austere environment to live in?
Definitely. And that's why we pick the right people, because actually you need to be able to not only survive, but thrive. So the Lunar Gateway will be an eighth the size of the International Space Station. And that comes with certain challenges, things like sleeping arrangements. That's fine, but things like exercising is an issue. So at the moment on the International Space Station, we've got fairly hefty pieces of kit that are heavy, that actually take up quite a large proportion of room for them to be able to develop their cardiovascular system, develop 2 hours per day exercising, to be able to maintain just the function to have mission success, let's say. Whereas if you're on the Lunar Gateway, we needed to develop a method that maintains those systems, but in a very short and small space. So one very interesting researcher and developer from the UK has developed something called HiFi, which is essentially a system which you push and you bounce from, but it develops your bone mineral density, your cardiovascular system, and it can be adapted to develop your muscle as well. But that's the kind of innovations that we need if we're going to take on these enormous challenges. It's very well Donald Trump saying, I want to go back to the moon, but equally, the human factor in that is enormous.
Yeah. And also things have changed though. Now it's been a long time, hasn't it? So is it exciting to see where tech's come and digital help? I would imagine it's going to be a whole different mission full of new learnings now.
Yeah. And I think it also will connect people far better to human spaceflight, because at the moment we've got the International Space Station. I think we take for granted that there's an enormous structure that's constantly orbiting the Earth that has had humans on it for an enormous amount of time. And it's quite hard to actually picture that. But as the public, we're always now looking for something more new, more exciting. And the moon will, I think, capture the attention of the world in a far greater fashion than we've seen since the initial moon landings.
Will it help at all the research that'll be done? Can it help in a way with climate change or anything like that? Any learnings that we can take from the moon and then possibly further down the line, Mars?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. There's obviously the argument that Elon Musk has, whereby he thinks that we are living on a dying planet, that we need options for the future, such as living on Mars. and whether you can get on board with Elon Musk's ideas or not, or certainly the way that he puts them across. You know, he is right. We are living on a planet that people fundamentally seem to not really care about too much, because otherwise we would change things that we're doing. And actually, politicians on an international scale, we really need to consider this carefully, because actually, if you think about 50, 100 years in the future, do we need to live somewhere else? But in terms of the translation of science, there's so many that I can't even go into with the benefits that you get from satellites and from being in orbit and things that we'll discover about the Earth from the moon as well. So I think it'd be really interesting.
Fascinating. And how far away are we then from human missions to Mars?
It's changing all the time. We said 2030 initially, or certainly one of the concepts is that we, on the far side of the moon, there's an enormous amount of ice, which we can break down into hydrogen and oxygen. And we can potentially use that hydrogen and the lack of an atmosphere. So part of the problem and the cost and the challenges with going to Mars from Earth is that it costs a huge amount of money and it's difficult to get out of our atmosphere, whereas the moon doesn't have that same issue. So if you can try and break down the ice from the far side of the moon to create hydrogen for fuel, actually that gives us a platform where we might go to Mars. But to be honest, I would hate to give you a date because it keeps changing. In fact, the moon keeps changing. So Mars is quite a long way away from us.
I'm just trying to imagine the conversations when you're at home and you get a takeaway with your wife and you're like, how was your day, darling? How was yours? And yours is full of Mars and the moon. And I'm sure hers is very interesting too, but it's much more interesting than mine.
Well, I don't know about that. I've had your conversations this morning. It's very interesting indeed. No, I know what you're saying. And actually my wife is very patient because I like to come up with new concepts. I like to come up with new ideas. And actually my brain is quite constantly on the go about things that may or may not happen. And she's an extremely patient person, as you can imagine.
Well, I think it all sounds really exciting. Tell me a bit about what's involved in designing the astronaut selection protocols, because you do that as well, don't you, as part of your business?
Yes. And I think one of the critical things that we need to focus in on now, actually, is that concept that people are going to be together for a prolonged period of time. I've developed software, for instance, that tests specifically for astronauts, their knowledge, their English language, clearly very important to be able to communicate well, and their maths ability as well. So it's kind of like fundamental principles of things you should know before venturing into space. But equally, one of the key concepts that is coming to fruition now that the Japanese do very well is having people in what we would call an analog and having them housed for a period of time so that you can really look at, I think you can mask yourself quite nicely for 3 days. But after 3 days, you start to expose yourself and your mask comes off and actually your true character starts to emerge. And that's what the Japanese do. So they put them in a module all together and then they use cameras and interviews to be able to tease out those nuances of their character. So that is certainly, in my opinion, the future of selecting humans for these prolonged and very difficult missions.
And what sort of tests do you do? Are they all written and speech tests, or are there some practical tests that you put the candidates through?
So there's hand-eye coordination tests. If you're in a very simple way, if you're using something like the Canada arm or robotics, then actually you need to be someone who probably can reverse park very nicely, or just to bring it back down to a normal concept. If that's something you struggle with, or if you've ever been on a boat and that whole articulated element to it, if that is a challenge for you, then actually this might not be the thing. So yeah, you need great hand-eye coordination. And then practically speaking, we tend to challenge them by giving them a task, giving them a limited amount of time to be able to read and understand, and then being able to apply that task in quite a speedy but an efficient, but also accurate fashion. So that's very much the learning process of an astronaut. It's lots and lots of different topics, but you have to learn them really fast. You have to retain that knowledge. And then at some point in the future, which may be days, it may be years, it may be multiple years, you need to be able to apply that really successfully. So that's what we tend to test as well.
It's made me quite excited because one of the few things I can do very well in life is reverse park.
Don't doubt that. I don't doubt it.
But I can't do, I would be useless at all the testing and all the rest of it, but I can do a nice bit of reverse parking. My poor dad would have never been able to go up for an astronaut because he, bless him, he died at 88 and he still only ever parked driving into a space forward, which meant he always had to have a double space. And it wasn't because he was getting on in years a little. That is how he parked. He never reverse parked. So just reminded me of that.
Great at other things, but maybe
he was a great journalist and great at words, but definitely not, wouldn't have been an astronaut. What about courage? How important is courage in all of this?
It's interesting, isn't it? So I've listened to your interview, for instance, with numerous other people, including Martin Pert, and courage is never something that once you're trained in something highly complex, you'd never describe it as courage. You describe it as actually the application of your training in a successful fashion. And actually, that's not really what the public want to hear. They want to hear that you're boldly going and
where no man's gone before.
But the reality is that actually, if we train people really well and we select the right people to execute that training, then courage shouldn't really come into it. I'm sure there are moments, however, in emergency situations where you need to compose yourself. And there was one recently with an Italian astronaut where his helmet filled up with water and he needed to get back to the airlock. And that there are moments like that in spaceflight. You might be coming back to Earth and there might be a problem with the craft where it spins out of control and you hit something like 10G in force. So you need to be able to compose yourself in that moment to execute your task effectively, not only to save your own life, but to save others. So there are moments of courage, but it's certainly your embedded training that comes to the forefront.
Which I suspect Pertty would have said too, when I'm sure you'll remember he became the Martin Baker poster boy for ejector seats when he was coming in to land in his Harrier. It was on fire and he ejected. And there's that extraordinary picture, which we used on the socials to promote the podcast, of Martin flying through the air with the fire coming out of the ejector seat. One could say he was courageous then, but you would probably say he was trained for that situation and for that high level performance. And that's, I suppose, part of what you accept when you're something like a fast jet pilot, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, it's funny because most of the people that I speak to that are in high performance environments, it's not necessarily the courageous actions, it's the courageous thought process that they've had. With the International Space Station, you've got several different modules and one person is in charge of each module and then you've got a commander. If you go to that commander and say, I've got a problem with my module, and these are the actions that I've taken, and you don't agree with the action that they take, that for me is more courageous sometimes than executing the training that we've had effectively, because it's truth against power. It's actually standing up for something that you believe in at a time where it may not be suitable for people. On many occasions like that, a difficult conversation can be more courageous than an action.
I think you're absolutely right. Just before we leave space, just touching on the microgravity, you mentioned at the beginning a little bit of what microgravity is, but how can you prepare astronauts to cope with that?
One of the methods that I developed with King's College London is to have a waterbed that you have people lie on for a prolonged period of time. It sounds very bizarre, doesn't it? And then we analysed their muscle tissue, their bone. We got them to do various function tests. We measured their sleep, their brain. So there are loads of ways that we can actually like measure people not in space to look at what their response might be. For astronauts, for instance, we do, I don't know if you've ever seen a human centrifuge, but it's something that looks like it shouldn't exist. I don't know if you've seen when you put samples in a really high speed spinny thing and you spin them around and then it separates the blood into like plasma and platelets. We do that with humans as well.
This isn't another podcast test.
It is another podcast, Helen, that's right.
Oh my goodness.
But you spin people around really fast in one of these long arm centrifuges and you replicate the G-force that you might experience during a rocket launch. And surprisingly enough, people act like samples. So their blood, it dissipates from their brain and goes down to their feet. And that has the obvious downside of people blacking out. And you've experienced this yourself. I remember you mentioning to me that you've worn some of the pants that blow up and push that blood back up to your brain. So during spaceflight, we have these maneuvers that we're able to do with that. But yeah, so that's just an example of one of the crazy things that we do with astronauts is we put them into very high pressure situations, spin them around very fast and look to see if they can cope with it.
That's amazing. I have worn G trousers. I was very lucky about 20 years ago. I did get to fly with the Red Arrows, which was amazing. And they didn't tell me before I went to do this for television that I'd have to have training on sitting on a live ejector seat. So I was quite shocked when I got there and realized I was actually sitting on explosives. And if they said eject, I really had to eject. But it was great fun. And that, as you say, the trousers blow up and they keep your blood in place, don't they? So when you're pulling G, your body's not drained of blood, I suppose.
Yeah.
It was really exciting stuff. Are any of your people that you're training with, working with now, likely to be going to the moon, to the new projects that we were talking about earlier with NASA?
Yeah, so the last 18 months, I've been working with the Middle East to develop their selection process, which was really exciting because actually hugely ambitious and gave the proposal that actually we want this to be the best selection there is. And what typically happens is each country has its own way of doing things. And then interestingly, you get a different astronaut as a result of doing that. So for instance, a European Space Agency tend to put knowledge tests first, and NASA don't do knowledge tests at all because they feel that with a master's degree or with a PhD, that you already have the capability to learn and retain knowledge. Your specific knowledge in an area is not something that is of interest to them. So yes, the people that I were working with sort of challenged us to say, we want to be the best at this. And if you can put forward to us what you would consider to be the best selection process that has ever been, accumulating what I've mentioned about Japanese Space Agency with the module, Canadian Space Agency with putting people under pressure, and the sort of behavioral elements of NASA, these are things that we would combine into something that's like a superhuman selection process. So yes, that has been my job for the last 18 months.
And does that continue now?
Yes, I hope so. So I'm waiting to hear back actually at the moment about bringing that to fruition. So we shall see, but I hope so. It's just one of those things that it's such a pleasure to work on things that you are so passionate about. And actually you can bring that to life for people and then you can see something as a result of it. So I really do hope that works out, but we shall see.
I think you've really found your niche, it sounds to me, but what you've done in elite sport would probably be worthy of a podcast of its own rather than a quick flash towards the end of the podcast. But I think at one point, weren't you only one of three women working in the Premier League? What did you do in football?
When I first mentioned that I wanted to work in football, I was coming to the end of my degree and, as you can imagine, didn't know a huge amount and didn't know anyone. But I asked someone for some advice and I said, look, I want to work in the Premier League. This is my only ambition. I really want to do this. And they put me in touch with two different people. One person from Manchester United said I couldn't come because I would put off the players. That for me was a real, they call it a psychological shunt, I think, where essentially you're put onto another trajectory of life, because it really shocked me that that would even be a consideration. And I worked so hard to be the best that I could possibly be. And I had amazing role models in someone like Dawn Scott, for instance, that worked for the Football Association. But I put every ounce of money, actually, time and energy into making sure that actually not only was I working in the Premier League, but I was a damn good person working in the Premier League. So the fact that I was a woman shouldn't have even come into play, but it did when it was put into my face. So I thought, right, okay, I've got this.
That's extraordinary. And what were you doing? Was it all the physiology stuff? Were you helping with the fitness and players' physiology?
Yeah, so what I was doing on paper and actually what I carved a niche for myself on were slightly two different things. So my job was to go around Premier League clubs and to work with all 20, implementing different scientific and nutritional aspects to their training. So essentially, I had a budget to optimize whatever area might be of use to them, and also that I might be interested in also myself. That had a number of different things, like at Chelsea Football Club with an amazing guy called Nick Broad, who unfortunately died in a car accident a few years later. We did some nutritional plans, and if you're eating, you can see different aspects of what your specific macronutrients should be. And then in Formula One, we would look at the caffeine levels of different race drivers and what coffee they were drinking before, because before it used to be quite sporadic in terms of how much coffee, but clearly to improve in a race, which is mostly down to reaction time, you want to be able to be specific about your caffeine. These are the kind of things that I sort of ended up doing. And certainly in the Premier League, I was very lucky because I got to live out my dream as a kid, but quite early on in my career.
Was that your dream to work in the Premier League?
Yeah,
had you always loved football as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely love football. I went to academy myself and always wanted to work in football. And it's really interesting because I worked in football for 5 years, and including women's football as well, and saw the growth of the Women's Super League. But it's really interesting. They say never meet your heroes. And some of them I was in awe of, and some of them I thought, actually, I could probably take or leave this.
Who were you in awe of? I won't ask you who you could take or leave.
Primarily, it was the players who, they were giving everything to the club and to the supporters. Quite often, football is criticised for none of the players really having a real heart and soul in the club. And for instance, working with Liverpool Football Club and having players like Jamie Carragher and Steven Gerrard, who would put their life on the line for that club, and then experiencing the atmosphere at the training ground and then experiencing the atmosphere at Anfield was like no other, honestly. And I'm saying this where my family are all Manchester United fans. I'm walking a thin line here. But,
oh my goodness. Yeah. And of course, McLaren's in Formula One. Was that also a dream like football? Because for many people, Formula One is just the pinnacle, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, I've always watched Formula One and I've always known the teams, the drivers, everything, but I'd never considered working in it until I started to, well, in fact, I was invited to go to a race. I think it was Monaco, speak to the head of performance at McLaren, and I had a conversation with him and I was just lit up by how interesting he was. So he'd worked with, I think, Hakkinen, and he'd worked with everyone, actually. I couldn't reel them off because he'd worked with everyone. And one of his lines that I remember, he said to me, I won't try and imitate him, but he just had a way of speaking that was really phenomenal. And he said, Tess, there are five elements to performance, and the key one is the fifth, which is your spirit. And I remember at the time I was sort of young, super keen academic person who was just reading everything I possibly could, just trying to pick up as much knowledge as possible. And this concept to me was completely alien because I thought, well, I can't measure spirit. I can't, how do I implement that? And that's really naive, isn't it? And now when I'm older, thinking back, I was like, yeah, he's entirely right. He is right. It just, the spirit is the thing that connects everything else together. And however, which way you cut that, actually, that's the thing probably that can enhance performance the most.
Gosh, absolutely. And was it great fun as well, working in Formula One?
Absolutely. So working with the teams, you think, right, going into an all-male environment as a short blonde woman, you're not going to have the best experience. It was the complete opposite. I can't even describe to you the just like fun and banter and just how wonderful everyone is, honestly. And I think there's a recognition also that this might be a bit hard for you. You're walking into a pit lane where it's 50 degrees centigrade. It's super hot. It's super loud. You've not worked in this before, but also recognition that you want to do your best for the people that are there. Do everything I can for them. And then in return, they do everything they can for me as well. So actually, I think Formula One was probably one of the best environments I've ever worked in.
Was there a driver or an experience where you thought, gosh, that marked improvement came from what I implemented and the advice they followed?
Honestly, no. And the reason I say that is because it's so multifaceted. So in particular, Formula One, where everything's down to a millisecond, it's really difficult to be able to account something to your actions or your decisions. And actually, I kind of wouldn't want to either, because that's very self-serving and I'm there to essentially try and do the best I can for other people. There was one idea I had that actually didn't really come to fruition, but I think if it would have been really good, it was about measuring the performance of the pit crew and actually analysing that and seeing what we might be able to do differently. So at that time, they weren't measuring things like circadian rhythms, or they were trying to, but not quite. So you can do that through different hormone levels. And they were sending them to races on coach when clearly flying business and sleeping at the right time is more important. And when you're changing tyres in hundredths of a second, things like this are really important, aren't they? Of course they are. My role used to be a little bit of a, I don't want to tell you the obvious, but here's the obvious. And sometimes it was the obvious things that were the most beneficial.
And then you finished your sports career as an Olympic and Paralympic head of performance too.
Yeah. So working with Olympic and Paralympic athletes is amazing because often they don't get the money or the recognition that they deserve. And actually, they're some of the most hardworking, amazing athletes that I've ever worked with. I've worked with athletes that have earned millions and millions, not paling in comparison in terms of their dedication, but some of the Olympic and Paralympic athletes, the amount of time and energy they put into something that actually very few people will know their name at the end of the day. Paris, for instance, would you even recognise them coming down the street? So yeah, for me, that's really impressive.
Yeah, we've featured Mark Ormerod, the triple amputee who won gold, well, I think numerous golds at the Invictus Games, actually. And when you hear somebody like that speak, you just realise what goes into the Paralympic Games and how there's just massive extra dimension to able-bodied sport.
I know, and it's things that you wouldn't necessarily think of. So I worked with a guy called Martin Hewitt who decided he wanted to do the Marathon de Saab, and we got him in the environmental chamber and cranked him up to the temperature that you would experience during that. And what we realized is that he doesn't sweat through his arm that he got shot in. So he was shot through the shoulder and he had to pinch his artery in order to survive. And he doesn't sweat through his arm. That's critically important because you're losing an eighth of your mechanism to dissipate heat. So it's things like that. Actually, we've got all the evidence in the world for able-bodied people, but actually the research there is lacking for people that may not be able to sweat. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, so much more to think about. As we draw to a close, because I was just looking at the clock and the time's just absolutely flown by, but I was going to end by talking about risk, and I suppose risk when you're working in the space world with astronauts and potential astronauts is a huge consideration. How do you view risk, Tess, and what's the biggest risk do you think that you've ever taken in your life?
So risk, as you rightly said, Helen, is enormously important in human spaceflight because these people are executing tasks accurately in a highly dangerous and volatile environment. It still is, despite how many launches we see, it's still an extremely dangerous environment, or it can be. The way that we view risk in terms of human spaceflight is that we manage and mitigate as much as we possibly can, but there's always that element of doubt. You can't research everything. You can't implement every safety measure there is. And people just need to be aware of that before they think about how cool it might be to become an astronaut, actually having that conversation with your family before going to say, I might not see you again. It's just one of those jobs similar to the military where you just don't know what might happen. So for me personally, I actually, ahead of going for my astronaut selection, decided to put myself into high risk situations. And I videoed myself doing them in order to see how I might respond. And for me, that was really important because it was a go, no go situation. If I stressed out under huge pressure that was threatening to my life, then that wasn't a job that was suitable for me. And I would acknowledge that and bow out. So I had one situation. I decided to become, and actually I wanted to build up the hours to become a commercial pilot. Whilst doing that, I was flying around America and my wife thought it might be a nice holiday to come with me. Instead of hiring a Mustang, we decided to hire an aircraft and fly around America. And then we realized that it was potentially a world record. We may as well go for the world record if we're flying around America anyway. Whereas it occurred to me, and bearing in mind, I had 10 hours of pilot in command experience before flying around America, which isn't very much. We met people that had thousands of hours and hadn't gone out of their state. That brought it into sharp perspective. But yeah, we had four emergency landings. And one in particular, I remember the smoke started to come through the grates in front of the aircraft. And when you smell smoke in an aircraft, that's never a good thing. And it wasn't at that moment where I was sort of worried about my own life and I knew all the procedures that I needed to do in the aircraft. I was thinking to myself that the most important person in my life is sat next to me. And actually, I've brought her into this and she's doing this for me as a supportive, amazing person. And can you imagine if I've done the worst thing possible to her as the person that I care about the most rather than myself? So yeah, I would say that's the biggest risk that I've taken. And actually, it wasn't anything about the situation or the danger that we were in. It was because I didn't want to lose an incredible person.
What a lovely note to end on. I just want to say a massive thank you, Tess, for coming and recording the podcast today. I think you're so inspirational. You've done some incredible things, but you're also totally down to earth and have managed to explain it in an easy to understand way, because what you do obviously is highly scientific and technical. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I have to say it's an enormous pleasure to meet you, and you've been such a wonderful person ahead of this and today. I hope we stay in touch, and you're welcome anytime. If I get a ticket to space, you can come.
Can I? Excellent. Well, don't forget that I am a good reverse Parker.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Dr. Tess Morris-Patterson talking about her extraordinary life and work as an aerospace physiologist and what makes a good astronaut as NASA prepares to go back to the moon. Download our podcast at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple and Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to yours. We've had a taste of the future today, talking about missions to Mars. But after a short lie down, I plan to take you back millions of years to prehistoric times on our next episode in the company of paleontologist Professor Paul Barrett from the Natural History Museum. I hope you'll join me then.